Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. You might have heard about last week's Supreme Court ruling in favor of letting the Trump administration use military funding for the president's border wall. But the administration made two even bigger changes that amount to the most dramatic reshaping of immigration policy in Trump's presidency thus far. One greatly expands Immigration and Customs Enforcement's power to deport undocumented immigrants without a hearing. The other named Guatemala a so-called safe third country that could have stopped asylum seekers from making it to the United States. Both policies face certain legal challenges, but what immediate impact could they have? So this hour on Point, understanding the Trump administration's two biggest moves on immigration. And you can join us. What do you make of the new rules to expedite deportations? What would you do if ICE stopped you and asked you to prove that you've been in the United States for at least 2 years? Join us at any time at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, joining us first today from Miami, Florida, is Alan Gomez. He reports about immigration, or reports on immigration, I should say, for USA Today. Alan Gomez, it's always great to have you. Welcome back to On Point.
Meghna, thanks for having me.
Okay, first of all, give us your 30,000-foot take on how significant these two moves on immigration are from the Trump administration. Are they a big deal?
It's really hard to understate just how big a deal these are. So first off, looking at the asylum issue and who can apply for asylum, this is the latest but by far the biggest proposed change that the Trump administration has put forward. They've been flooded with all these migrants coming from mostly Central America, requesting asylum at the U.S. border, complaining their asylum laws are not adequate or just allowing them to come in, make their cases, and stay in the country while their cases are adjudicated. So what we've seen over the past couple of years is the administration try all different kinds of approaches to try to limit that. They tried to end asylum for victims of domestic abuse and gang violence, and that was blocked by a federal judge. They tried to block migrants who entered the country illegally from applying for asylum. That was blocked by a federal judge. Trump ordered his administration to start exploring the idea of, for the first time, charging asylum seekers for their right to apply. That's being reviewed right now by the Departments of Justice and Homeland Security. They've tried – right now they're implementing a plan called Remain in Mexico, where after they apply, they have to return to Mexico to wait for the adjudication of their case. And I can go on and on. There's been others. But this other one that they've finally brought out a couple of weeks – or that they just brought out is even bigger than all that. It would effectively block asylum for over 90% of people making claims.
Okay. So how does it accomplish that?
It makes the argument that if you cannot apply for asylum in the U.S., unless – if you cross through a third country and didn't request asylum there. So if you're from Guatemala and you pass through Mexico, you have to request asylum in Mexico and be denied before you can request asylum in the United States. If you're from Honduras or El Salvador and you cross through Guatemala, you have to request asylum there first. And the argument is this all goes back to this idea of being a quote-unquote safe third country, that if a migrant passes through a safe third country, they should request asylum there first before reaching the United States. Attorney General William Barr described these folks who just come straight to the United States as forum shopping. But the other side of that is there's a lot of questions about the safety of seeking asylum in Mexico for these Central Americans. Guatemala remains one of the most dangerous countries in the world, despite improvements there over the past decade. And so that's where we find ourselves right now.
So Alan, let's help us understand this in detail, right? Because it's quite complicated, and I want to be sure that that we get a real handle on what's going on here. So regarding Guatemala, though, there was an accord signed between the Trump administration and the Guatemalan government, right? Ostensibly, the nation of Guatemala has agreed to serve as a quote-unquote safe third country, has it not?
They have, But there are many, many questions about that. So just two parts of this. First, the Trump administration first tried to unilaterally implement this idea that you have to request asylum in a third country. That was blocked last week by a federal judge in San Francisco, where the judge, John Tigar, he's a federal district judge in San Fran, said that there is a, quote, mountain of evidence that forcing people to stay in these countries is not a safe proposition. Mm-hmm. So that part of it is blocked in the federal courts. The Justice Department is appealing that ruling, so that'll run its course through the courts here in the United States. But then a few days after, that was on Wednesday, and then Friday, the president comes out and announces that he's signing this, quote, safe third country agreement with Guatemala, wherein Guatemala agrees to adjudicate those cases, let people apply for asylum there, possibly offer them work visas while they're there. But the problem is, even in Guatemala, that's not so sure of a thing. They have an outgoing president there who's very unpopular, whose administration is the one that signed this agreement. Mm-hmm. They did so under threat from President Trump to impose tariffs and to tax remittances that Guatemalans in the United States send back to Guatemala. That basically, Trump was threatening all kinds of economic ruin on that country. And also, there's $170 million in foreign aid that we used to send to Guatemala, but that has been cut off by President Trump. So in Guatemala, there's a lot of resistance to that agreement. The Constitutional Court is saying that it's invalid, that he can't do it. The Congress says that the president can't do it alone. Both of the candidates for president coming in have opposed it. So there's a lot of resistance there as well. So we just don't know right now whether that agreement is going to stand in Guatemala or in the United States.
Right. And so just to add to the texture here, I mean, as far as I understand, even Acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan isn't officially calling this a binding agreement between Guatemala and the United States. And to your point about Jimmy Morales, the Guatemalan president, soon to be outgoing president, if he in fact, I think he put out a tweet saying Guatemala has avoided these punitive threats from the United States. And that was one of his motivations for signing for Guatemala signing this accord.
Yeah, he's very excited because the business community in Guatemala was up in arms. These threats from President Trump to impose tariffs, whether it be on Mexico, as we saw earlier this year, or on Guatemala just last week, they work. I mean, they are, for each of those countries, the U.S. is their main trading partner. The idea of taxing remittances that Guatemalans in the United States send back home is a huge deal that makes up 12% of Guatemala's GDP. So these are very real accusations, and they take them seriously. So on the one hand, they're happy from the economic standpoint in Guatemala that they may have that it looks like they've avoided that. But on the flip side, every humanitarian group that I've found says that it's a sham, that it's the idea of Guatemala being a safe place for people from El Salvador and Honduras is just laughable.
Yeah. So, Jimmy, Alan, let me just jump in here for a second, because to that point, right, I mean, we have what, more than 150,000 Guatemalans themselves trying to leave their nation virtually every year. And I'm seeing numbers here that last year, Guatemala received only 260 asylum applications. Do they even have the legal infrastructure to absorb hundreds of thousands of asylum applications that might be pouring through the country now that it's quote unquote a safe third country?
Not right now. I mean, that's just something that they're unaccustomed to. When you look at the number of people who are coming to the United States to request asylum, the majority, the country, or not the majority, but the country with the largest percentage is Guatemala. 194,000 Guatemalans so far this fiscal year have come to the United States to request asylum. That's one indication of the you know, state of security in Guatemala right now. And their homicide rate has fallen in recent years, but it's still within the top 15 in the world. That capacity of the Guatemalan government to be able to process these cases, it's just not there. They haven't had to do it historically, and that's not just something you hire a couple of people real quick and turn on. That takes a long process to hire the people and to have the infrastructure and the processes in place to do so.
So we will talk more about this asylum issue and safe third country issue with Guatemala a little later this hour. But Alan, I want to dig in to the other big news from the Trump administration last week about the expansion of ICE's capacity for expedited deportation. So what's happening there?
Yeah, and this is one that's, it's another one that's a little bit complicated to understand, but I'll try to kind of break it down very simply here. In 1996, Congress allowed for this process called expedited removal, which allows Department of Homeland Security personnel, so think Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents, ICE agents, Border Patrol agents, to, on their own, deport an undocumented immigrant from the country. No immigration judge, you know, that level of due process is not there. They can just on their own make the determination to deport somebody. Previous presidents have used it to a limited degree. Currently, as of a week ago, it was only used against undocumented immigrants who were caught in the previous 2 weeks within 100 miles of the border. Mm-hmm. So the idea being getting the people who obviously just crossed over, we caught them near the border, okay, that's an easy case, it's clear cut, let's get them out of here. What the Trump administration just announced is the idea of expanding that expedited removal process to the entire country and to do it against undocumented immigrants who've arrived in the previous 2 years. So that vastly expands the number of people that could be subject to this sort of process. But it also raises all sorts of concerns about just how one person can just make that determination, make it fairly, and ensure that people aren't getting caught up that shouldn't be.
But I mean, look, the Trump administration in the Federal Register, when it expanded this policy last week, it said it harmonizes essentially expedited removal policies that have been evolving since 1996, as you point out. That's the Clinton administration. The George W. Bush administration also slightly expanded it. So did President Obama. So it's been sort of on this march. Is it not a natural next step to say we need to have sort of universal policies across the United States regarding expedited deportation of undocumented immigrants?
Yeah, I mean, when I read the statement, that phrase harmonizes it with federal law. What it really does is takes it to the full extent possible under U.S. law. Mm-hmm. So as you mentioned, when it was passed, Clinton was president, and he limited its use only to people caught at ports of entry. George W. Bush came into power. He expanded that to people caught within 100 miles of the border. Obama maintained that. And so what Trump is doing now is just going all the way in, all in, everywhere around the country.
And so we're seeing immigration advocates saying that they're deeply concerned about who it might have an impact on, including perhaps even U.S. citizens who get detained. So we are talking about two major changes the Trump administration has enacted about immigration policy. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about two major changes the Trump administration recently made to immigration policy in the United States. One has to do with considering Guatemala a quote-unquote safe third country for asylum seekers. That might prevent many thousands of people from seeking asylum status in the United States. And another one expands ICE's power to expedite deportations of undocumented immigrants anywhere in the United States if they cannot prove they've been in the country for at least 2 years. I'm joined today by Alan Gomez. He is immigration reporter for USA Today. He's with us from Miami, Florida. We're going to bring in a couple of other guests here in just a minute or two. But Alan, we've got lots of callers already, so let me turn right to them. Let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Sarasota, Florida. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, Andrew.
Hi. Well, it's been a while since my con law days, but the way I see it, it is unconstitutional for any American law enforcement to stop people and ask them to prove that they belong here. I mean, it was said in the Articles of Confederation that people have the right to travel in the United States, and I see that as enforceable under the 10th Amendment of the Constitution. Mm. It's just un-American for a uniformed officer of the government to demand papers from anybody.
Mm. Andrew,
we have the presumption of innocence.
Thank you for your call, Andrew. Alan, let me fact check something with you. Andrew's call makes me think, just to be clear, will it now be possible for an ICE agent anywhere in the United States to walk up to anybody and ask them about their immigration or citizenship status?
We're not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we're kind of waiting for, those sort of operational guidelines from ICE to explain how they're doing it. But to address Andrew's concern there, that already happens in some parts of the country. If you drive along a lot of highways throughout the Southwest in any of those four border states, and I'm not just talking about right on the border, you can be 10, 20, 50 miles in, and there are Border Patrol checkpoints along these highways. You know, Border Patrol calls that part of their layered border security approach. But yeah, you'll be driving down I-5 down there, and there's a Border Patrol checkpoint, and you just roll through, and they'll quickly look at you sometimes and say, are you a citizen? If you say yes, they'll let you go through. There's been some challenges to that, whether that's a legal thing. But right now, ICE, if they have a, quote, reasonable suspicion that somebody's in the country illegally, there's a possibility that they can start asking those questions now wherever you are in the country.
Has ICE clearly enumerated what those reasonable suspicions might be?
It's always difficult getting that kind of information for them. I mean, one of the things that happened under the Trump administration prior, under the Obama administration, if ICE was going on a raid to arrest a specific undocumented immigrant that they knew had a serious criminal record or something like that, they were under orders to only go after that person. But now, as soon as Trump came into office, they removed that. So now when ICE goes on an operation, they can arrest that person and anyone who happens to be in the room, who they encounter along the way. So there are untold numbers of cases around the country where ICE is literally asking people in their driveways and starts chatting them up. And then if they develop that reasonable suspicion during that conversation, suddenly they get taken away.
Well, let's bring in a couple other voices into this conversation. Joining us from Austin, Texas is John Daniel Davidson. He's immigration and border policy, an expert in immigration and border policy for the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's a free enterprise research institute. He's also a senior correspondent at The Federalist. John Daniel Davidson, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington is Oor Jadoo. She was the chief counsel of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, a component of the Department of Homeland Security, served in that position from 2014 to 2017, also served as the chief counsel to the Subcommittee on Immigration and Border Security in the U.S. House, and is now director of DHS Watch, a project of the immigration reform advocacy group America's Voice. Oor Jadoo, welcome to you.
Thank you for inviting me.
So I want to first start by playing a little bit of tape from acting director of USCIS, Ken Cuccinelli. He spoke on Fox News last week about the administration's new policy regarding expedited removal. And here's Cuccinelli.
This creates a much smoother and more expedited removal process. And that is a big part of our problem, Shannon, is that there's so much due process. There's so many opportunities for illegal immigrants to throw wrenches in the works of our legal system, and Congress has allowed them to do that, that it takes forever to get through the due process pipeline.
That's the acting USCIS director, Ken Cuccinelli, was speaking to Shannon Bream on Fox News. Oor Jadoo, what's your response to Cuccinelli saying there's so much due process and that's a big part of the problem?
Well, first of all, I'm quite curious about the fact that the USCIS acting director, which is a services agency, is speaking about removal deportations, which is an authority inside ICE, not USCIS. So that makes me a little bit curious. But the second part of this is too much due process. There's a reason why we have due process, and I think your caller Andrew, as well as Alan, have clearly pointed out the dangers of not ensuring proper due process in the removal of someone inside the United States. We've heard the stories of U.S. citizens being locked up in ICE detention. There was the recent one of Francisco Galicia, who spent about more than 3 weeks in ICE detention trying to sort out whatever was the confusion between ICE and this individual and his family. And he's not an isolated incident. There have been, since 2012, about 1,500 people who, after investigating citizenship claims through ICE, were released. And so this expedited removal expansion, if we already have those numbers at that level, this greatly expanded expedited removal will only increase that number by large numbers. Mm. And that is what concerns me most.
Well, John Daniel Davidson, let me ask you. I mean, Cuccinelli basically said it's the slowness of the courts that he sees as part of the problem. So let's remove due process altogether and just deport people without a hearing. How is that an actual solution?
Well, it's not an actual solution, but it does identify the problem. And the problem right now is that the courts are overwhelmed. And the fact that the courts are overwhelmed and that it takes years and years for asylum cases to be adjudicated is itself a major incentive for people to seek asylum in the U.S., where they can get authorization to work and send money home or reunite with family members. It's important to understand the full context here. Everybody who's apprehended at the border, essentially between ports of entry, is subject to expedited removal. And the families from Central America and the unaccompanied minors that are coming across are all subject to expedited removal. And what is happening is that they are claiming asylum, and they claim asylum as a defense against removal. And they're given a credible fear interview. The vast majority of them pass that credible fear interview and then can pursue an asylum claim. And that begins a process that can take years. And I think what Cuccinelli and others in the Trump administration are trying to get at with all of these policy changes and with their statements is that the system itself, because of the backlog, has created an incentive for people to seek asylum in the United States who might not otherwise actually have valid asylum claims.
And so, but back to point taken, but how does this solve that problem?
Well, I said earlier, yeah, it doesn't really solve the problem. All of these changes are sort of Band-Aids to try to deal with a very uncomfortable reality. And that is our entire asylum system and our immigration system is not set up to deal with what's happening right now. Just like our border facilities on the actual border are not set up to house families and children. They were set up to deal with single men coming across from Mexico. Our asylum system is not really equipped to deal with the numbers of people seeking asylum right now. You have nearly a million case backlog right now and wait times of 2 years or more.
Okay. So Urjadu, would you like to respond to that?
Yeah, I would agree that our system does not have the proper resources at the moment to address the challenges at the border. Certainly that's true. There are a little less than 400 immigration judges to deal with all the cases coming before them. But this is not a new problem. We have had this issue for many, many years now. The courts have been underfunded, and they have been volleyed back and forth with regard to the authorities they have to handle their own dockets and to greatly create efficiencies that, at the same time creating efficiency, also protect due process. And that is a problem that lies with funding. We need to fund more immigration judges, more staff support for those judges, and the process would move through much smoother, in addition to ensuring that people that are going through the system understand what they're going through. They need legal assistance, and the process would be much more efficient for everybody involved and would save quite a bit for the government.
Yeah. Alan Gomez, let me turn back to you, because, again, there's so many complications here and certain aspects of these policies are unclear that I'm going to turn to you repeatedly to help help us be sure we understand what's going on here. Because I'm seeing some numbers here that, you know, multiple administrations obviously have used expedited deportation, as we've talked about a little earlier in the show. But roughly 50,000 immigrants in 2004 went through the expedited deportation process and were removed from the country. That number in 2013 jumped to 193,000 under the Obama administration. That was, what, 45% of the total number of people deported went through this expedited process. I mean, do we have any sense about how much more the Trump administration's new policy could grow that number?
Yeah, and to be clear, those are very big numbers, but it's important to note those are, again, people caught within 2 weeks of crossing over within 100 miles of the border. So what we're talking about there are more of these recent border crossers that where the case is very obvious. You know, usually they're people caught that day or within a day or two. So people caught right at the border. What this does, expanding it to the entire country, you know, I've seen estimates of over 350,000 additional undocumented immigrants who are living in places like Nebraska and Kansas and places that are that far from the border will now be exposed. And that's the difference. Is it's one thing to say, to catch somebody, you know, if a Border Patrol agent catches somebody jumping over the wall, you bring them in, all right, expedite a removal, all right, go back over there. But it's quite another thing for an ICE agent to encounter somebody in Kansas and on their own determine when that person arrived in this country, whether they're here legally, whether they have any claim to asylum, whether they have any kind of claim to any other relief. And it'll be up to that ICE agent on their own without any judge, without any ability to appeal, to make the decision, nope, this person got here within 2 years, no legal claim to be in this country, you're out of here. That's a very, very different proposition.
John Daniel Davidson, does that concern you?
Well, of course it concerns me if that's how it actually worked. But keep in mind, anyone who's subject to expedited removal can claim asylum as a defense against removal. And so let's not pretend that there's absolutely no due process in that. When someone claims asylum, they're then interviewed by an asylum officer to determine whether they have a credible fear. If the asylum officer determines that they don't have a credible fear and that they can't apply for asylum, that migrant can appeal that decision and be heard before an immigration judge. So there's due process even in that first step. And of course, if they are determined to have a credible fear, then they can proceed with the asylum process, which, you know, they're assigned a court date and it's a very long process from that point out. And even after that, they have the right to appeal. So I don't want us to give the impression that expedited removal, whether it's at the border or whether in the interior of the United States, means there's no due process. That's not quite accurate.
Okay. Urjadu, would you like to respond to that?
Yes, I would. I'm that type of due process will apply to people, only people who have claims to asylum and are seeking asylum. But what about the U.S. citizen? What about the lawful permanent resident? What about the person who has a visa status? And then what about the undocumented person that's been here for longer than 10 years? More than 60% of the undocumented population is well-rooted. They've been here for longer than 10 years. In addition to the fact that there will be some undocumented people who will be victims of domestic violence, which Congress has very clearly stated is protected under the law, what are they to do if, on average, expedited removal results in a deportation of 11 days? How do you have time to gather the documents to show and prove without any process, without any oversight, simply an immigration officer stating, no, I don't believe you. I don't see any documents. I don't see any evidence. I've gotten your travel papers. You're headed back to your home country. That is the concern. And certainly that is correct. There is a right to apply for asylum, but for people to know that and be aware of that in this quick process inside the U.S., where for many, many years now, nobody has known this process has existed. And now, through some Federal Register notice, which I can guess most Americans don't read on a daily basis to check to see what's new in the law, that now they need to be prepared for the possibility that they could be removed within 11 days if they don't have the proper documentation ready and available to prove to just this ICE officer that they shouldn't be.
Well, I want to get one call in before we have to take a quick break. So let's go to Bill, who's calling from Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well, Bill. What's your thought?
Well, you started the show by saying, let's look at the view from 30,000 feet. Let's look at it from 50,000 feet. And in a 50,000 feet view, our world has about 7 billion people. Hundreds of millions of them are living in horrific conditions and would love to come to the United States. And even more than that, are living in great conditions. We'd still love to come here because I'm sure you've, like me, traveled around the world. This is by far the best place here. How do we control that? Well, through laws. The upper side of the country, how many people do we want to let in? 100? Is it 100 million? 200 million? I don't care, as long as it's done through a democracy. And then we need to set up controls and quotas. And that's how our system works. So this idea of just open borders and letting people come in, and when they are, I lived in Switzerland decades ago. Every 2 weeks, there was a knock on my door. I could only stay there for 18 months. They would knock on my door and make sure I'm still where I'm supposed to be before I had to leave. But anyway, the big picture is, yes, we can't solve all the world's problems. We can't let everybody in. We need to control what's
Bill, I'm going to take it back from you there because we got to take a quick break, and your phone line was a little hard to hear, but that's Bill from Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts, saying that he thinks the only way to solve the problem at the 50,000-foot level is through laws and quotas around immigration. So, Bill, thank you for your call. We are talking about two major immigration policy changes from the Trump administration in just the past week, and I'm joined today by Alan Gomez, Ur Jadu, and John Daniel Davidson. And we will take a quick break and be right back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair. A new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about two sweeping policy changes the Trump administration very recently made about immigration. One would expand ICE's power to rapidly deport undocumented immigrants found anywhere in the United States. And the other has to do with asylum seekers and the naming of Guatemala as a so-called safe third country for asylum seekers. And we want to hear from you about your response to these major changes from the Trump administration. I'm joined today by Alan Gomez. He's immigration reporter for USA Today. He's with us from Miami. Ur Jadu joins us as well. She's director of DHS Watch, a project of the immigration reform advocacy group America's Voice. She's with us from Washington. John Daniel Davidson joins us from Austin, Texas. He's immigration and a border policy expert for the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's a free enterprise research institute. He's also a senior correspondent at The Federalist. And let's hear a little bit about the case of 18-year-old Francisco Irwin Galicia. He is a high school student and a U.S. citizen who was wrongfully detained in a U.S. Customs and Border Protection facility. After more than 3 weeks in detention, he actually considered agreeing to leave the country, even though he's a U.S. citizen. And then he told CNN why he considered it.
The truth, threatening me that they were going to press charges for falsifying documents, the whole time insulting me that how could I not know where I was from?
Galicia did not leave the United States, and he was eventually released by Customs and Border Protection on July 23rd. So we got some questions about this issue of U.S. citizens being detained. So let's go to Carmen, who's calling from Tuskegee, Alabama. Carmen, you're on the air.
Well, thank you so much for taking my call. I had felt that this very issue was not getting a lot of attention. Perhaps people didn't really understand. I have a friend and a coworker whose two children were held. The son was speeding. The son and the daughter were stopped. And we don't have papers for citizenship, apparently, that are necessarily guaranteed to prove that we're citizens, because they had passports, they had driver's licenses, they were born in the biggest hospital in Atlanta. They could have checked any of those things. They stayed in the in captivity for 3 months. The last month of their captivity was after they already knew, because they required them to take DNA tests. After they already knew then that they were citizens, they still had to stay in prison another 30 days until they were able to meet with the judge.
Uh-huh. Well, Carmen, thank you so much for your call and for that story about a coworker of yours. Let's go to Salim, who's calling from Hartford, Connecticut. Salim, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead, Salim.
As we know, we are diversified nations. That's what makes us a great nation on this planet, one of the greatest nations. We look different, we speak different. How about myself or one of my loved ones is out there without documents, not feeling well, or some mental illness, can't explain himself or herself. And next thing we find them, they cross the border because there was no due process. One person determined he or she looks different, belongs to the other side of the border.
Mm. Well, Salim, thank you so much for your call. So John Daniel Davidson, let me go to you first. You just heard two people. They're very much concerned about the difficulty that they know people have had even proving their U.S. citizenship after detention by CBP or ICE.
Yeah, absolutely. And the prospect of that happening is frightening and is understandably frightening for everybody in this country, no matter what their status is. I think, though, that we have to understand that the crisis at the southwest border right now is above all an asylum crisis. It's a crisis of families and unaccompanied minors coming to the border and claiming asylum and beginning that process. And so, you know, ICE doesn't have unlimited resources, and they're going to target their enforcement, I would think, toward groups of people that they believe are part of this asylum crisis. You know, we talk about border security or immigration reform. It's an asylum crisis. That's what's happening. And no amount of border security, whether it's a wall or border enforcement, whether it's ICE agents going into the interior of country, is going to stop the crisis until we reform our asylum laws and we set up a system that can quickly adjudicate asylum claims, so we don't have the backlog, so we don't have the years-long waiting times, so we don't have this huge incentive for people to come and file asylum claims so that they can work in the United States and be reunited with family, essentially economic migrants.
If I may, let's be clear. When you say that ICE is going to target its enforcement for people who look like they may be part of this asylum crisis, you're talking about ICE racially profiling people who look like they're from Central America. That's what you're talking about.
Well, I don't know if ICE does that or not. I don't exactly know how ICE is going to target their enforcement or what they're going to do. My point is that we shouldn't pretend that ICE is this sort of like all-seeing, all-powerful agency that is going to sort of fan out into every city in the United States. They have always, not just under the Trump administration, but under the Obama administration and previous administrations, had to target their enforcement. And as you mentioned earlier, your guest from USA Today mentioned earlier, during the Obama administration, the focus was on people with criminal convictions or who had committed a crime. And the focus has changed from administration to administration. So I don't don't want to scare your listeners into thinking that, you know, thousands of ICE agents are fanning out across the country to round up people. I don't think that's what's going to happen. I don't think we know exactly what's going to happen at this
point. Since you mentioned Alan Gomez, Alan, let me bring you back in here. What do you think about what John Daniel Davidson just said?
I mean, he's absolutely right in the sense that there has been a seismic shift in the nature of migration along that southern border. Just a few years ago, the majority were Mexican males crossing over, trying to evade Border Patrol agents so that they can get into the country and work. And in these last few years, it's shifted where the majority are now Central American families who are actively seeking out Border Patrol agents to request asylum, and that has overwhelmed our system. What's unique about this, though, the point of contention has been how the Trump administration has reacted to it. I was down in San Ysidro, California last year in October with Kevin McAleenan, who's now the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. And I asked him the question, look, you've brought down the National Guard, you brought down the active duty military volunteers from all these different agencies to kind of respond to these migrant caravans and to respond to the threat of people crossing over illegally. But has there been any similar effort to take care of these people and to adjudicate their cases more quickly and to better house them? And this is just as recent as October. And his answer was, we're viewing this purely as a law enforcement situation. That's why it's only been until this year that the administration has requested money to improve the living conditions of migrants along that border. Mm. That's why you're seeing so much of these different efforts to limit and kind of little by little unilaterally take apart the asylum system, when what's really needed from both sides is for Congress to actually get together and really update the system, provide the funding necessary for the judges that Ur was talking about, to improve the asylum laws that John was talking about, and to really solve that. But we know how likely that is in this climate. So.
Right. I mean, we've just been through a pretty heated debate over exactly that issue in the past couple of weeks. But on that point, though, let's go to Zach, who's calling from Oskaloosa, Iowa. Zach, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm very interested in what the panel has to say about as far as Trump just bringing to light different issues. So there's obviously an immigration issue within this country. And like it or not, what policies he's put in place, something he's done is he's brought that to the forefront. And I think something that really bothers me in watching it from the outside is we have a Congress who wants to get tied up in the peripheral issues of legitimacy of his presidency or different things like that, rather than talk about the big picture immigration and fix that. It's let's get caught up in, well, what do you think of this particular policy? Well, let's fix the whole system.
Yeah. Zach, I'm going to turn your question to the panel here in just a second, but I'm just curious, when you say that there are immigration issues in this country, like specifically in your mind, what are those issues?
Well, I lump everything into like the border security, so the border wall. Do we need a border wall? Do we not? I don't know, but we have Trump talking about it. This should start a conversation for immigration reform policy, streamlining the process into the U.S. DACA. Do we allow them to be approved or not? You know, this is stuff that needs to be answered, and until it is, we're just going to have this constant bickering back and forth. But we have a Congress that is elected to take care of these issues and to protect the sovereignty of this nation while allowing us to be this amazing melting pot that we are. And it's just not being done.
Yeah. Zach, thank you so much for your call. So, Ur Jadu, let me turn back to you on that, because there are so many issues, to use that word here again. I mean, Zach talked about DACA, and just you know, we might behoove us to remember that there was an attempt to find a solution for DACA recipients in roughly the first year of the Trump's presidency, and it was the president himself who kept moving the goalposts on that for both Republicans and Democrats. But what's your take on Zach's sort of call for Congress to step up and do more to solve the immigration issues, as he says?
Yeah, I actually would agree with not just this caller, but also your previous caller, Bill, who was talking about it from the 50,000-foot level, in the sense that we do need a legal, orderly system, a modernized immigration system that works for the country, that works for our economy, that works for families inside the U.S. that wish to be reunited with their families, which is a lot of the issue at the moment, that adheres to the values that we've held for decades and are at the moment being questioned. And that does require Congress stepping in. The last time they made a major modernization of the immigration system was 1990. And it's almost 30 years later. It's time for the country to revisit that. And the Congress has tried a few times, has not arrived at a consensus that has passed both houses of Congress and made it to the president. But the idea would be to get there and modernize the system so that it recognizes the realities of the country's needs and allows people to work, not in the shadows, outside, paying into the systems that we would require for everybody, that brings people into our legal systems and ensures that families can be together.
Yeah. I want to return just for a minute to Guatemala and the naming of Guatemala as a safe third country, because that deserves a little more explanation. And so first of all, let's listen to California Congresswoman Norma Torres. She's the only member of Congress originally from Guatemala, and she was on CBS News on Friday criticizing this agreement that we've been talking about between Guatemala and the Trump administration to label that nation a safe third country.
It is unconscionable to think that Guatemala, one of the countries that has the highest murder rate in the world, at least within Latin America, could be a safe country for people that are coming from Venezuela, from Cuba, and some other countries that are in deep trouble. To think that that is a country that could accommodate asylum seekers from anywhere else in the world, it is ridiculous.
It's California Congresswoman Norma Torres. Now, Acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McAleenan talked about this very agreement on Fox News.
Guatemala has really stepped up. We signed an agreement in May where they're tackling the alien smuggling organizations, and now on Friday, adding to that, addressing asylum together and trying to return the understanding of what asylum really means in international law.
Alan Gomez, what does McAleenan mean there when he says returning an understanding of what asylum means to international law?
I mean, there's traditionally been this idea that you should seek refuge in the first safe country that you arrive in. But we get back to that question of safe.
Right.
I mean, and that question about capacity. Look, there are tens of thousands of people that are trying to get to the United States to request asylum, and they're not. And it's for a reason. If you're from Honduras, if you're from El Salvador, and you try to request asylum in Mexico, not only is it going to be difficult to do so there or in Guatemala, but you get all the other factors. Mexicans aren't particularly fond of Central Americans and aren't going to give them a bunch of jobs. Like it's a very, very complicated place. And obviously the security issues that we're talking about are front and center. So asking Guatemala to basically take over and solve this problem for us, a country of 17 million people that is mired in all sorts of political corruption, that is mired in all sorts of violence and insecurity and all sorts of economic instability, that's asking a lot for a country that has almost no history with this.
Mm. So John Daniel Davidson, we've just got about a minute or so left here. It occurs to me that if the Trump administration, I mean, they have been successful in getting Guatemala to sign this agreement, whether or not it will hold together is a different story. But that shows some kind of influence that Washington's having here. So perhaps would it behoove the Trump administration to use that same influence to assist Guatemala in solving its internal problems so that it could become a real third safe country?
Absolutely. Look, we have to understand that the countries that are sending these families and unaccompanied minors to our southwest border are essentially failed states or are in failing states. The corruption in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador is stupefying. There's a recent piece in the New York Times called Pay or Die about corruption in Honduras. It pervades every aspect of society, and it goes right to the top of the government. That's true in these countries. And the Trump administration is in a position where it can put pressure and leverage on the elites in Central America to get serious about tackling corruption, to get serious about tackling drug cartels and organized crime. And until that happens, and that's going to include U.S. aid, but it's also going to include direct U.S. assistance like we saw with Plan Colombia in the 1990s. Until that happens, we're not really going to have a long-term solution to the border crisis.
Well, John Daniel Davidson, immigration and border policy expert for the Texas Public Policy Foundation. That's a free enterprise research institute. Also a senior correspondent at The Federalist. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Ur Jadu, she was the chief counsel for U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services from 2014 to 2017, now director of DHS Watch, a project of the immigration reform advocacy group America's Voice. Ur Jadu, it was a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for including me.
And Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, thank you so much for guiding us through these complicated issues and changes. It's always great to talk with you.
Thank you, Meghna.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.